南无塔萨玛嘎瓦托阿拉哈托萨玛萨布塔萨南无塔萨玛嘎瓦托阿拉哈托萨玛萨布塔萨布当塔曼桑康那玛萨弥bright, warm weather we have the last few days, and this being also Easter weekend. These are themes which come to mind. It's often said that pointed out how the festival of Easter in the Christian Church is one of a long succession of different kind of springtime religious observances and spiritual traditions from different religious forms from pre-Christian times and the Greeks and the different cultures through the world celebrate this time of renewal of the life coming back into the world, all the spring greens, the new leaves coming forth, the life emerging again from the ground. So you know, this time, all these different images and traditions that surround Easter, just the word Easter itself, it's to do with the rising of the sun, whether the sun comes up, the rebirth of the energy, estrogen. Also, same Easter, same all the kind of Easter eggs, and so forth. These ways that the kind of fertility of the world is celebrated, these different kinds of images, symbols are used around this time. Oh, when we contemplate the Christian story, the festival of Easter is principally about the conquest of death. If you think about the crucifixion and then the resurrection, this is also a particularly powerful symbol, and it's also with different religious traditions, people can get very tied up, particularly in the scientific, skeptical, materialistic, rationalist domains of thinking, that we can get very taken up with the questions of genuine, real history or of biology. How can we possibly talk about resurrection? If a person's dead, they're dead. They don't come back. They don't come to life again. The materials can be recycled, but no one dies and gets up again. And so that we can be dismissive about these sort of stories because they don't match biological fact or they don't match sort of historical fact. Well, everyone knows that there were all sorts of Greek mystery traditions that had a, you know, almost identical pattern to the Easter story. You know, there was one, I forget exactly which city they used to observe this, where after the spring equinox, the people would ceremonially carry in a young pine tree, would be carried into the city with great pomp and circumstance, and then the tree would be ritually slaughtered, put to death, and then buried in a cave, and then after 3 days out of the cave would emerge a golden youth who would then be crowned the kind of Devaraja, the kind of the spring god. See, well, of course, you know, that just shows you, you know, it's Christianity just kind of ripped off the myth and put in their own heroes and recycled it, and it's all, you know, it's all this kind of a story, it's all meaningless. But it's if we have this kind of rationalist, literalist approach, we can miss a lot of what's useful about these stories. That and the power, the usefulness of a myth is not in whether it kind of fits scientific models or whether it's got some sort of accurate names, dates, places, but whether the story is meaningful to us, whether it can help us, whether it maps onto our own life in some significant and valid way, and then can guide us towards a greater understanding of ourselves, of life, a greater clarity and peace of heart. At least this is how I approach all, you know, religious and spiritual teachings and stories. It's, you know, particularly as meaningful myth rather than trying to establish this sort of more hardline factual elements. So the Christian story is definitely symbolizing the conquest of death. There's the experience of Jesus being killed and executed and then coming back to life. And certainly that the all of the symbols that surround the Christian story, you know, encourage this. It's it is the time of spring, the time of emergence of the triumph of life. So we can consider, well, what does the what use is this story to us, or how can it be helpful? How does it map on to our own life? Also, within the Buddhist tradition, the same quality, the conquest of death, is depicted in very, very different symbols. With the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, or the Bodhisattva before the Buddha's enlightenment, sitting down under the tree of enlightenment and determining not to move from that spot until he had awakened to the truth. And so in the Buddhist story, then you have the Bodhisattva being assailed by the hordes of Mara. And in Buddhist mythology, Mara is the lord of illusion, the tempter. Also, Mara means death. So that the Buddha's resolution to sit and to not move until full realization had taken place, then what attacked him was the forces of death, of the forces of the powers of the mind that tie the heart to the conditioned realm, to the realm of birth and death. So probably most of us are quite familiar with the story of the Night of Enlightenment. The Buddha is first of all assailed by the forces of fear. Mara sends his demonic army and they try to attack and frighten the great being with terrible soldiers and weapons and so forth, and all of the weapons that they hurl at the Buddha, nothing can harm him. That as they throw spears at him, they turn into shafts of rainbow coloured light, and all of the arrows they fire at him turn into flowers and rain down to the ground around him, and nothing can nothing harmful can enter the space under the Bodhi tree. And the Buddha sits there, resolute, clear, awake. And he doesn't fight back. He doesn't sort of duke it out with Mara. He's not kind of getting angry. He's not getting upset. He's not contending. But the way that the Buddha defeats Mara is just through the knowledge of what it is, what's happening, that this is just mental events. This is just the experience of fear, of threat. So the Buddha is always depicted as responding to Mara by saying, "I know you, Mara." And when, as soon as Mara is known, then he's foiled. He's defeated. Curses, foiled again. So then the next army of Mara is the army of attraction, allure. And he sends in his beautiful daughters, assuming all kinds of different forms that might be possibly attractive to the great being. And again, he realizes what this is. He says, "I know you, Mara." And even though the images are very attractive, interesting, alluring, he still is unmoved. Then finally, the forces of responsibility. Mara sends in the images of the Buddha's home country and his aged father, begging him to come home, take over the kingdom. And again, the Buddha is unmoved. So by the end of the night, Mara's armies have all failed, and then the Buddha, even though they've all failed, Mara tries to still claim them. He's actually the Lord of the world, and he has the right to sit at the immovable spot on the Vajra throne, the Vajra seat under the Bodhi tree. And he says, "You know, I'm the Lord of the world. I'm the one who's really in charge here. You know, isn't that so?" And he turns around, and his 700,000 strong army. Everyone says, "Yes, indeed, Lord, that's the case." "See, I've got witnesses, you see, everyone agrees, I'm supposed to be there, you know, you move along. You're just a fraud, you know, you gave up on your wife and kid, and you gave up on the ascetic life. What kind of a monk are you supposed to be?" You're just a hopeless failure. And then the Buddha touches the earth, and reaches down, touches the earth, and calls forth the earth goddess. And the great mother appears, and as the Buddha's witness, and says, "This is my true son, and he has done everything necessary to claim full and complete enlightenment. He is the one who has the right to claim sovereignty over all things. He is the one who is truly awake, truly the master." And then she produces this flood from her hair, and all of Mara's armies are washed away. And then they, after they've dried themselves out a bit and got themselves together, they come back bearing gifts and apologies and saying, "I'm terribly sorry. Didn't really mean it." And this is how, in the Buddhist mythology, the Buddha conquers death. So very, very different stories of, you know, Jesus being nailed to the cross, you know, and dying, and then going into purgatory for 3 days. This is where we are at the moment. We're in the purgatory period, and then on the third day arising again, rising from the dead. But whatever the complex of symbols that we use, what's being embodied in both of these traditions is the fact that death can be conquered, that death is not the end of the story, that there's some quality in our nature which can transcend even that most formidable of presences in life, as death, the inevitable death of the body, the inarguable, inevitable end of all beings, that can be conquered. Amazing, incredible. Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was a very great philosopher, monk, and one of the great bright lights of Buddhism in Thailand, was also very involved with other religious traditions there, and collaborated with Muslims and Christians and other spiritual groups over many years. And in a series of commentaries he gave about the Christian teachings, he said the symbol of the cross was the letter I, or the word I, deleted. So that the crossbar is like I crossed out. This is what the cross means. He says, yeah, it's very good that Christians carry a cross around their neck. It's a very good symbol. Because if we want to transcend death, then what really needs to go is me. I is the thing that's the chief culprit of tying the heart to the realm of birth and death. What can it mean that we escape from birth and death, or that we transcend death? In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful never die. The heedless are as if dead already. Well, that maps out the territory a little bit, doesn't it? So the mindful never die. So obviously it's not talking about physical bodies. Otherwise there'd be an awful lot of very, very old arahants still walking the planet. The bodies die. Even the Buddha's body died, if we take him as our archetype. So it's not, when we're talking about deathlessness, it's not a matter of just preserving it's certainly from the Buddhist point of view, it's not a matter of just of preserving the body, but it's talking about a different dimension of our being. And when the when we use Buddhist terminology, one of the ways of describing enlightenment or someone entering upon the path to enlightenment, so then it's oftentimes described as saying that the deathless has been realized. Like, say, for example, when Sariputta first heard the teaching from the Bhikkhu Asaji, and then he went back to it, and then hearing this verse, he immediately became a stream enterer, entered upon the path to enlightenment. And then when he went back to see his friend, Mahamoggallana could see that Sariputta was very clear and bright, and so Sariputta told him, yes, because they'd made a promise to each other that whoever realized the deathless first would go and tell the other one. So Sariputta came back and said, yeah, the deathless has been realized. The deathless has been seen. So it's important to say, in the Buddhist understanding of things, it's not as though deathlessness is a thing that we acquire, but it's a dimension of our nature, of the nature of things, which is realized. So it's not like that which is born is then suddenly changed and made into a permanent condition. But it's like the uncovering, the discovering of that in us, that in the nature of our being, which is deathless, which is unborn, which is timeless. So this is what these teachings point to, and they symbolize, is that the possibility of this, and the power of that, the transforming capacity that has. Like, if we could discover that, what a difference it would make to the way that life is experienced, known. What a way it would change the way that we relate to the beings around us, the world around us, our own life, our own body. When we begin to intuit this quality of deathlessness, this element, the amata dhatu, the deathless element, the Buddha never really described that in any great detail. There's not a whole sort of long philosophical analysis, but more he gave his attention to describing the pathway to realize that. So we have very sort of broad, simple terms like the deathless, or nibbana, nirvana, the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated. These kind of terms, they don't give you a lot to grab onto. They're pointers. They're words that catalyze that intuition in the heart that says, yeah, that's right. There is something in me knows that is true. Is conscious of that, so that the entry onto the path of enlightenment is, in a way, one of the terms that's used is changing our lineage, because normally we think of ourselves: I'm this person, I'm this body, I was born in 1956, and I live at this address, and yeah, I am this individual, this person. It's a very matter-of-fact thing that we identify with those elements, those characteristics. And, you know, these are my parents. You know, Tom and Pat Horner, these are my parents. So the entering of the stream is where there's a radical insight into the fact that the body is not self. Feelings are not self. Perceptions are not self. The personality is not self. This is not truly and completely who and what we are. That's a dimension, an element of our experience, but it's not the absolute truth of what we are, what is real. So that the path is a lot to do with letting go of that identification with the body and the personality, realizing this is not me, this is not what I am, this is not myself. And when that realization occurs, then it's like then. Whereas we relate to the body and then where the body came from with our own physical parents and so forth, and we let go of that as being sort of where I came from, quote unquote, and we begin to recognize the unconditioned, that the unborn, the timeless reality of Dhamma, of the truth, we begin to see, oh, well, that's more of a realistic way to say kind of where, quote, I come from, unquote, or what, quote, I am, unquote. So it's a change of lineage by seeing that the source of our life is the unconditioned Dhamma, not Mr. and Mrs. Horner or whoever our parents happen to be. That is not as though that, you know, our parents sort of dissolve. It doesn't negate the relative truth, but it transcends it goes beyond it. And this is not just an idea, but this is really like a change of heart, a change of vision. And we see, oh yes, this personality, this body, it's a costume that we put on. It's assumed for a while, a mask. It's a persona that is assumed for a while and is functioned through, and then it's laid aside, it falls away. That's all. So when we talk about not dying, It's not a matter of, as I was saying, it's not a matter of like sort of the things that were born then being preserved. But the heart no longer identifying or seeing that the identification with those things that were born was, it was an identification made in error. That was never truly who and what we are. So that then as the heart lets go, as we begin to see, you know, the reality of that, then the whole way which we relate to the comings and goings of things, successes and failures, praise and criticism, you know, birth and death of bodies, it changes enormously. It's more like being in the theatre with a good story than it is taken so personally. That's like our dear friend Mary Curran, living next door and finding just a few weeks ago that she was very seriously ill with cancer and now closing in on her death. But she, you know, she's a very spiritually mature person, very clear in her mind, and so, you know, these at such times as this, then the heart is confronted with these kind of questions and challenges, and that it's these times where one can, you know, sometimes see more clearly than usual that all the things that we habitually thought we were and that we were busy doing and we were in the middle of. Just like this evening she was saying, yeah, the priority list, you know, changes. the things that seem were important, a lot of them fall away, and other things that are truly important get to the top of the table. And just sitting with her this evening, we were over there doing some chanting and then sitting quietly afterwards. And one of the passages from the teachings came to mind, and it was where the Buddha was questioning one of the monks about, you know, how he would describe an enlightened being after death. And the monk just says, well, that which was born, that which came into being, has ceased. That's all you can say. And the Buddha says, well done. That which was born has gone to cessation. Yeah, the rest cannot be spoken about. And so, sometimes people will be very frustrated about, you know, like all that effort to get enlightened, and then, you know, and then after it's all over, there's like no payoff. What? What about the finale? Like, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Okay. So if you don't get it quite right, you go off to some fantastic Brahma heaven for 84,000 eons of unutterable bliss. But then if you really get it right, then no shoe, no dropping. And so that's been very frustrating for about 2,500 years now to a lot of people. Like, and they say, well, why, you know, surely there must be something that can be said. And the Buddha was amazingly resolute throughout his teaching career. He never would say anything about that, even though he was misunderstood and misinterpreted, and it sounded like it was that silence that he had in it was represented a kind of nihilism where you just sort of evaporate, you just kind of disappear. But the Buddha was resolute in not speaking about it, because he said, you know, that nothing can describe that. He said, one who has reached the end has no criterion by which they can be measured. That which can be spoken of is no more. You cannot say they do not exist. But when all modes of being, all phenomena are removed, then all means of speaking have gone too. So that he didn't try to make a kind of makeshift description or go into sort of wonderful metaphysical poetry, but just said, basically, okay, here's the path, this takes you to the door, go through the door, you'll find out for yourself. then you won't need the words. But the words can only get you to the door. Beyond the door, the words don't apply. It's like a currency that loses its value once you cross the border. You know, or like in France, all your francs are worth nothing. Now you can just paper the bottom of your birdcage with them. The francs no longer exist. They have any value. They're all euros now. So it's the currency. So it's like the currency of thought and language is like old francs and Deutschmarks. They no longer apply. This is for the birdcage, you know, for the recycling. They have no value. So the Buddha was prepared to be misunderstood in that, because he saw it was more valuable to preserve the mystery of that quality, rather than trying to paint a picture of it just using limited dimensions of our thought and language. It's rather like, you know, you can draw a picture of a glass. You know, I could spend hours, days drawing a beautiful picture of this glass, but if I try and pour water into the picture, then the water will just spill all over the place. So similarly, trying to draw a picture of ultimate reality, or the reality of the nature of a being that is beyond time, individuality, space, and identity, what that would be like. The reality of words and concepts can't contain the dimensions of that truth. So that the Buddha encourages the realization of that truth, but then leaves this wonderful mystery for what happens after we die. And so you get these quite sort of simple, prosaic statements like that which has arisen has gone to cessation. But then also, just why I think the one that came to mind was just being with Mary and just feeling her kind of aging and her kind of the diminishing of the energy, but incredible brightness and sort of clarity in the room. And that which was born, that which has come into being, is going to cessation. It is ceasing. The organs are packing up. You know, the system is slowing down. It's ceasing. The condition of that came together and was Mary Curran for these 70 odd years, it's now winding down, ceasing. But the obvious presence of that which is not born and not dying is, you know, kind of in a way gets louder and louder. It's like a silent roaring of that presence. It becomes clearer, you know, when it's received with mindfulness, known with open-hearted mindfulness. Then we in a way apprehend that great silence, that great presence that was, you know, like as I say, it becomes more and more tangible at these powerful times of fading and dying, if we can receive it. And it becomes much more palpable, more clear. That which is unborn, that which is timeless, that which is invulnerable, and that which is not tied to birth and death, in a way gets closer to the surface of consciousness. Now, talking in this language of birth and death, it can sound a little bit grandiloquent and not much to do with my life. But these are processes that all of us are involved in, both on the physical level of our own physical death, of these bodies that will come one day, but also on the everyday births and deaths of praises and criticisms of, you know, the rice getting burnt, the shelf falling down, the appointment being missed, etc., etc., etc. You know, the thousand little births and deaths of a day. And when we really understand what the deathless is, when we really know that we get a deep intuitive sense for that. We recognize it, we awaken to that deathless element, then we can see for ourselves, we can know for ourselves, like the deathless life experienced from that position. One of the ways I like to symbolize this or speak about it that maybe makes it a little bit clearer is now it's night time. The frogs are all chirping down at the river. The sky is dark. The stars are out. It's cooling off. It's night time. And then tomorrow morning, the sun will come over the hill. It'll be day. And you know, we can say, yeah, the sun will rise, come over the horizon at 6:03 a.m. in this particular day, this particular time, this particular latitude, and it will set at such a time. And the rising and the setting of the sun is predictable. It's very clear. There's daytime, it's bright and clear. There's nighttime, it's dark. And so the rising and the setting of the sun seem to be inarguable realities. We can map them, we can time them down to the second, the microsecond. And so just as with these bodies, you can say, I am this person, I am Ajahn Amaro, I am a man, I am an English person, I live here in Redwood Valley, my address is 16201 Tongkai Road. That's who I am, that's where I am. And just as we can say the sun comes up at 6:03 in the morning, goes down at 6:38 in the evening. But if we look at our life, our birth, in a similar way, like born at sunrise, and then the sun goes through the sky, and then as the sun sets, then we can think of that as our death. But those appearances and disappearances, they only pertain because of being on the surface of this planet. If we leave the surface of the Earth and go out into space, then the sun stops rising and setting, doesn't it? Unless we're spinning around. You know? If we say take ourselves out of the orbit of the planet Earth and just position ourselves in space, then the sun doesn't rise and set. It only rises and sets because of this body being located on the surface of the planet. It's the spinning of the planet that makes the sun rise and set. So similarly, it's tying the heart to the spinning of the changing facets of nature, tying the heart to the body, tying the heart to moods, tying the heart to thoughts and feelings. That's what creates the impression of our little psychological births and deaths and the physical births and deaths. When the heart is not tied to, identified with the body, the personality, then it's like us leaving the surface of the earth, you're leaving the orbit, the pull of gravity. And taking the position of the sun, then the sun doesn't rise and set. That there is no being appearing, being born. There's no being that is dying. That is seen very clearly from that position of the unborn, the undying, the deathless. That the just like being off the planet and watching the earth spin. It's like, yeah, it spins, right, great, marvelous, both, so it's like when the heart lets go of all the comings and goings, the risings and ceasings, the births and deaths, then we say, a mood comes, a good mood comes, bad mood comes, it's a wholesome thought, an unwholesome thought, there's vigor, there's laziness, there's pain, there's pleasure, there's hunger, there's fullness, there's praise, there's criticism, there's success, there's failure, there's health, there's sickness. Very nice. Just like being at the position of the sun, watching the earth spinning off in the distance. We also can watch the spinning of the events of our life. And so as the body as it reaches its end and fades and dies, then it's like, a body goes. And then, if we haven't quite finished our business, and then we pick up another another body comes along and says, oh, that's interesting. Back in the maternity ward again. And round it goes. Another body gets born, then we do a childhood, there's a childhood thing, and high school, and get born, short pants romance, etc., etc., and aging and death. Now, I don't want this to sound like a sort of, you know, clinical appraisal. It's not like a sort of a cold, a distancing from the elements of the physical material world. This is one way of describing it. You say, well, I really like the earth, and I really I want to go off into space and hang around. It's cold and dark out there, really chilly, and no oxygen either. You know, I like the world with its kind of plants and its frogs and its people and my irritating family and my ingrown toenails and my digestive problems and my, yeah. Well, fair enough. But just putting these things out so that we see, well, yeah, from certain times of day, in certain moods, we can appreciate the charm of all of that. But when we truly let go, and when the heart does rest in its own nature, in this in the deathless, the birthless, the immortal, timeless, then what we experience is not a sort of cold, surgical appreciation of life at all. Actually, the experience of being from that position is one of incalculable richness and attunement to life, a fondness as a deep compassion and loving kindness towards all beings, a great affection, benevolence towards all beings, all things of the world. But in that letting go, in that abandonment, there's also its partner, which is an utter say affinity, an attunement, a belonging. Right, now these might seem to contradict each other, but this is really the strange mystery of the middle way, that when we let go of everything completely, the more that there's a total abandonment of the conditioned realm, then by this strange, you know, ironic chemistry, the heart finds itself more utterly and perfectly attuned to the world of things than it ever was before. It's hard to describe, but this is how it is. So we also come now to the death of our retreat. This is, you know, last Saturday night. So tomorrow is the March 31st. The retreat officially closes. It's the death of it. But if the heart has been born into the retreat, then the heart will die with it. You know, or if the heart was born into the retreat and then we awoke to the deathless, then when the retreat dies, we won't die with it. So the body dies, that which has come into existence goes to cessation, but, you know, the heart is no longer tied to it, is no longer attached to it, is not. It's realized its natural, innate unentanglement. A symbol that Ajahn Chah used to use, which also I find very beautiful and compelling. He said it's like if you have a vessel with oil and water in together, like a bottle, a corked bottle. Mostly our life is so full of love and hate and busyness and ups and downs and attractions and aversions, that the oil and the water, the bottle has always been shaken, that there's a constant agitation going on. So that the fluids in the bottle seem to be one thing. But when we train the heart and learn to awaken, to let go, to not pursue the habits of identification, and we just see that nature is just nature, that we don't take everything so personally, then it's like we stop shaking the bottle. The bottle stops shaking. And as soon as the bottle stops shaking, then the oil and the water separate out from each other. You don't have to have a committee meeting to decide whether it should or it shouldn't. You don't have to have a discussion about who's going to end up on top, or whether it's a good idea, whether they should separate or not, or whether they really want to. There's no decision making is needed. The innate immiscibility of the two, the difference of densities, means they separate out. So similarly, the heart is the heart, and the conditions of the natural world are immiscible. They separate out. That which knows is intrinsically transcendent. And so as soon as we stop shaking it up together, that knowing is one thing, and then the known, the conditions of the world, all the born and dying, they separate out. But they ease apart from each other. They're in the same vessel, they're both in the same life, in the same mind. But they ease apart, they separate out naturally from each other, so that it's not like we have to create or get this quality of the immortal, the transcendent, the divine. It's already here. It's just if we just stop shaking the bottle, we just allow ourselves to like step back and appreciate that that clarification, that separation happens on its own. It's very easy, easeful. And in that separation, this is what we mean by conquering death, transcending death. So there's the symbols that we use to describe that, whether it's Jesus being crucified and then arising from the tomb and ascending into heaven, or whether we talk about the Buddha under the Bodhi tree and the battle with Mara. Whatever symbols that we use, it's really talking about this very transformation that happens in the crucible of our own heart, that recognition that death can be conquered. Death is not the final story, it's just a piece of the picture. And that when we recognize that, we allow those symbols, those stories to soak in, to speak to us, to guide us, then we find that quality of deathlessness. We're empowering the intuition of that, we're strengthening the intuition of that. We're able to awaken to, that's always been the case. How amazing, how wonderful. It's always been here, but I overlooked it. And then the quality of joy and freedom, of delight that comes with that is indescribable. And the Buddha, at least in the Theravada teachings, refrained from waxing too lyrically about it. He just kept saying, just do it. Don't write poetry about it. Just do it. A little poetry is okay. But the main thing is to allow the intuition of that value to soak in and to act on it, to let it in, and then to allow the heart to experience that wonderment on its own.
Anyone?